You're listening to Decolonize Social Work, a conversation about social work, oppression, and liberation. I'm your co-host, Ondine.
And I'm your co-host, Drew. Hello, everyone. It's been a minute, hasn't it?
It has been a minute.
Yeah. It's amazing what having a cold for 2 months will do to your budding podcasting endeavor.
Yeah, that kind of got in the way.
And
the holidays and a lot of other personal stuff.
We care about our listeners so much, we didn't want them to have to listen to us sniffle for a half hour while we talked about really cool stuff.
That's right.
Because this cool stuff shouldn't have distractions, right? So, speaking of some stuff that we're going to talk about, today we're actually going to do a deep dive into what white supremacy culture is and what it looks like maybe when it manifests in our social work profession.
Exactly. I'm glad we're talking about this too, because I know that we use these terms a lot, and getting to spend a little time sort of defining them practically, I think, is really important.
Yeah, because we've talked about it a little bit too, about we want everybody to be on the same page, have operating terms, but really this is going to be a focus specifically on just white supremacy culture.
Yeah, yes, exactly. With a focus on then how that shows up for social work.
Okay. Well, what do we got that we're using here?
All right. So we are building this conversation off of an article, a paper written by Tema Okun called White Supremacy Culture. And you can find it for free at dismantlingracism.org. But we're also going to post links to the stuff we talk about today on our social media.
Yeah, so, on our website.
You know, you will be able to find it there. But this piece that she's put together also builds on the work of a lot of other people and organizations, and
over like 10 years of work too, right?
Yeah, it's impressive. So this article has been organized into like 10 or 12 different characteristics of white supremacy culture.
Okay.
So I'm going to read those characteristics, and then we're going to come back around and talk about, well, what makes those characteristics of white supremacy culture?
Yeah, I think it's a great question too to kind of resolve for people, because I'm sure those are questions people are going to have, because these are kind of common concepts that we're all familiar with already.
Yes. All right. So I'm just going to read these through, and forgive me the paper shuffling here. We've got a lot of paper in front of us, guys.
We come prepared. Yeah.
So, perfectionism as one characteristic, sense of urgency, defensiveness, quantity over quality, worship of the written word, only one right way, paternalism, either-or thinking, power hoarding, fear of open conflict, individualism, I'm the only one, progress is bigger, more, objectivity, and the right to comfort.
You know, some of those we've already talked about a bit, things like objectivity and paternalism. I'm glad that we're going to spend some time focused specifically on these things, because we've talked about them in the context of other things, but this is just laser focused on those things specifically.
Yeah, so this is a long list of characteristics of white supremacy culture, but they aren't just those characteristics because you and I think so, or because Tema Okun said so.
Yeah.
Why are they?
Well, I think that a lot of these, whether we work in private business or nonprofits or independently, a lot of these have become just the norms of our culture.
Yeah.
Whether that is by design or by accident, the end result is the fact that a lot of us do these things. And I don't know if we always are coming at this work critical of why we do these things. And so I think unpacking what the origin of these things are and what they're continuing to do is important as we go forward in social work, and kind of in the mission of this podcast too, which is to decolonize social work. And if we're unintentionally, unwittingly replicating or using the structures of colonizing frameworks, we have to be able to recognize that stuff.
So if these are the norms, who set them?
That's a great question. And obviously, anybody who has had the capacity to write rules or develop norms were usually people in charge.
Yeah.
And people with power, whether it was a plurality of representation or just had almost like an apartheid.
Yeah.
They were the minority but still had the most power. Those are the people who always established the norms that most of us would end up following. And so,
and who are those people?
In this country, in the United States, it was white people. White male cishet people who typically had a financial leverage over some people as well.
And let's not act like that's not still the case.
Yeah, and it is. And it also is a good point here, very much recognizing that this isn't limited to the borders of the United States. This is a global problem.
Yes.
I think a lot of it starts here. and has pervaded other communities and cultures around the world. But I think the development of this stuff, you really see that happen in the United States and Western Europe.
Yeah. So you and I, when we were chatting about putting this together, you said that this piece also kind of made you think about something that Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz had said.
Yeah. I've referred to her book in a previous episode, The Indigenous People's History of the United States, and she talks about white supremacy culture and how it isn't intrinsically linked to skin color, but it most often does connect to people's skin color.
Okay.
So you can be, more often than not, white people are going to be the ones that participate in white supremacy culture, but you also don't have to be white to participate in it and to reinforce this or do these behaviors. At the same time, it is possible for white people to reject white supremacy culture. So again, it's not just inherently linked to what your skin color is or what your race is, but more often than not, it does kind of overlap with those two characteristics.
So even the best organizations, nonprofits, social service agencies, the best people can be complicit in perpetuating this culture, these characteristics, these norms, right?
Because part of it all is, we're not coming up with these norms individually, and it just all spontaneously happened that we had the same frameworks, right? These are all things that trickled into our organizations because of the culture we live in, which is a culture based on white supremacy norms.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is especially important for us as social workers, because if we are tasked with trying to alleviate suffering and struggle and oppression from people, we've got to do critical work of making sure that we're not just playing along with the rules that the culture...
The dominant culture, which is responsible for a lot of this oppression.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. You know, we have to be able to recognize these dynamics at work, and then we have a responsibility to work to dismantle them. And I would also go in to say that these characteristics, which we will dig in deeper about, also are just bad for us. They're unhealthy. It's this kind of stuff that perpetuates burnout in the social work profession.
Absolutely, it does.
And you mentioned this already, but I just want to like lift this up again. These characteristics, we're focusing this conversation today a lot of like the workplace. I think the last couple times we've chatted, we've talked about social work education, but I want you
They've taken a beating enough from us for a couple of episodes.
We'll be back for you. Yeah. Y'all haven't fixed your stuff. But we're going to think about the workplace today, and social workers work everywhere. Some of us work directly with clients, some of us are administrators, some of us run organizations, some of us write policies, you know, we do case management, we're therapists, there's a ton of stuff. So, but whether you work in an NGO, a nonprofit, a for-profit, a hospital, wherever you work, this stuff shows up. All right, well.
Well, let's get started into unpacking the first term that you read off, actually, which was perfectionism.
Let's get in.
Yeah. Do you want to share a little bit about what Tema Okun defines as perfectionism?
I do, yeah. So, perfectionism. There is little appreciation expressed among people for the work that others are doing, and appreciation that is expressed usually directed to those who get the most credit anyway.
Yeah.
Another point. Perfectionism, more common is to point out either how the person or work is inadequate, or even more common than that, to talk to others about inadequacies of a person or their work without ever talking to them directly. Okay, I feel called out a little bit.
Well, yeah, I think anybody listening to this probably is feeling that with you, though, with me as well. As you were sharing some of that, I just started thinking about every situation I've been in at work where basically, we just kind of, it wasn't even just benign gossip, right? We were kind of talking shit about people behind their back and not addressing it directly with them, whether it was interpersonal issues or like we thought they were not doing a good job at the tasks that they were doing.
Yeah. Well, let me get in a little further here. Yeah. Also, an example of perfectionism is that mistakes are seen as personal. So they reflect badly on the person making them, as opposed to being seen for what they are, which is just mistakes. Making a mistake is confused with being a mistake, doing wrong with being wrong. Another thing is there's little time, energy, or money put into reflection or identifying lessons learned that can improve practice. In other words, little or no learning from mistakes, right? Because we're all avoiding the mistakes and just kind of painting people as bad.
Gosh, that behavior of attributing actions as mistakes into people being mistakes, I feel like has been a tool to continue to disenfranchise women, women of color, people of color from the workplace, because we take their actions as representative of them as a people, not just individually, but even as their communities.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. This also spoke to me, too, under perfectionism. It's often internally felt, like inside us personally. In other words, the perfectionist fails to appreciate her own good work, more often pointing out his faults or failures, focusing on inadequacies and mistakes rather than learning from them. The person works with a harsh and constant inner critic. Also, that makes me feel called out.
You know, we sometimes almost jokingly say, like, oh, I'm my own worst critic. But, like, why should we be so hard on ourselves with this stuff?
So, you know, something that I have a question, right? Which mm-hmm. is some folks listening to this might be like, well, I'm a perfectionist. There's nothing wrong with that. That just means I end up putting forth the best work all the time. So how is perfectionism connected to white supremacy culture?
So that makes me want to clarify something. Like, we're not calling for people to slack off and do a less than acceptable job. This social work, it's
right.
serious. We want to do the best work we can.
That's right.
That's not the same as perfectionism. And so I think the concept of perfectionism and how it relates to white supremacy culture does kind of, on one hand, mirror things like efficiency and
time is money.
Time is money. The timekeeping is a big thing with perfectionism. Anybody that's ever had to clock in at a certain time and you got dinged if you were supposed to be there at 9 and you showed up at 9:02.
Which is like, I mean, what about having your butt in the seat at 9 o'clock makes you a better employee?
Right. And I realize that there are people, too, whose shift ending is dependent on somebody else relieving their shift, like a 24-hour organization.
But
like,
we're not hurrying our butts up to get there at 9 a.m. because we're trying to take care of one another, right?
Right. We're doing
it's because
it so
we're going to get dinged.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You're absolutely right about that. So these characteristics about perfectionism kind of sound like something else I'm pretty familiar with, too, which is capitalism. And capitalism is inseparable from white supremacy culture. We do have to point that out.
Yep.
That, like, these are one dirty hand dirtying up the other hand at the same time.
It's all a hot mess.
Yeah. Two heads on the same monster, sort of Hydra grossness. And so, perfectionism, again, isn't equivalent to, like, doing your best. Doing your best is awesome. We want to lift people up to do their best. But at the same time, can't be so critical of those slight differences that becomes trying to fit. Because what is perfect, too?
Well, and best is subjective.
Yeah. But we act like it's not, right? We
right.
act like, oh, you're going to be measured on your performance on certain characteristics, and we're not going to consider alternative ways to measure your quality of your work.
You know, this makes me think about also how then that plays out for social workers in the way that they feel about their clients or the way they see their clients. And, you know, having clients who face a lot of barriers, who are doing their best and are actually maybe pretty savvy when it comes to getting their needs met. But I have definitely heard social workers expect things of their clients that are completely unreasonable and are unable to, like, lift up or see the amazing things that they do because they're not perfect.
I'm also feeling called out right now.
Mm.
Not personally, you know, like, as a personal affront, but I just at recognizing behavior I've done. Sometimes at various jobs, we have unfairly critiqued people for not being perfect clients.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they will need our services more than once, and pejorative names get attached to them.
That's, you know, awful.
Frequent flyers,
ugh,
return clients, these sorts of things that really, let's lay this out, what we're doing. We're criticizing people for using a service we offer.
Yeah.
And again, the perfectionism part is that you should only need this service once, and then your life should be great.
Mm-hmm.
But we've talked about before in this podcast how oftentimes, what does it mean to help somebody in a situation and then they go back out into the world and the systems that exist that cause those problems are still in effect? So it's really unreasonable
yeah.
to expect one person to just need our services once if the problems are still out there.
And it's really ugly the way that I think about how this builds on itself. You know, like, I'm a social worker. My boss is riding my ass to be at work on time at a certain time. I'm like 5 minutes late and they make my life really bad. And so in turn, I'm really frustrated with my clients then who aren't showing up on time for their appointments. And I'm thinking badly about them, all because we're stuck in this time clock mentality where we have to be perfect and efficient.
Inefficient. Yeah. So all of this kind of begins to create this toxic culture. And I think it highlights what you said, too, which it kind of emphasizes or exacerbates burnout.
Yeah.
If we're expected to be performing perfectly all the time, and perfectly is something not even clearly defined, it's just somebody who had the ability to write the rules and the norms decided that this was what was going to be perfect, again, it's only going to work against us.
Yeah. I mean, it fosters a lot of animosity, too, between colleagues. I've definitely been in work environments, too, where this cult of perfectionism, which, you know, we know is a tenet of white supremacy culture, mm-hmm. really impacts the way that you feel about the people down the hall. If you feel like you're doing your best based upon whatever, and your fellow social worker does things a little bit differently, it really kind of divides us instead of appreciating one another for like having our own style and our own way of approaching the work. It's just, like you said, it's pretty toxic.
Perfectionism also kind of dovetails or overlaps with another of those concepts you mentioned, which is also objectivity.
Hmm.
Because as you mentioned, perfectionism, and you're not really worried about other people's style or the how they do things. We're all the time critiquing people to basically remove themselves from the work that they're doing in order to fit into this mold. And we've somehow identified this mold as the perfect mold because we don't want people bringing their personal experiences in. We don't want people having emotional reactions to the clients they're working with.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to say that the perfect social worker is somebody who doesn't do that is really gross.
Yeah, I know. And it wasn't when we were preparing for this conversation where we also talked about the venting in particular, right?
Yeah.
And how that fits into this.
Right. And venting kind of does have a negative connotation to it, almost like there is just some complaining about it. But I don't think that in this concept we're saying that you shouldn't ever decompress or just unload the mm-hmm. stuff you're carrying.
Mm-hmm.
But are you talking about things from almost like using the I statements that we always talk about people using? Or are you projecting that onto other people?
So venting, sometimes people call it water cooler talk.
Yeah.
Just, if that word isn't something you're familiar with.
Yeah.
But it's basically, like you said, the practice of getting together with your colleagues and blowing off steam. And I think people would be hesitant to say that there's something wrong with that. In fact, I have a lot of social work friends who have said, we need a way to, like you said, decompress.
And we do.
But it is a symptom of all of this that we're talking about, this perfectionism piece of being hypercritical, and that when people do something wrong, it's an indictment on them as human beings
mm-hmm.
rather than maybe they made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just go off to the break room and talk about how awful of a person they are.
And so that kind of leads me into something, because I don't want to just point this problem out, right? Like, Tema Okun has some antidotes to these sorts of these concepts, right? So,
mm-hmm.
like, do you want to share a little bit about what some of her suggestions are?
Yeah. So some of the things that she says can combat perfectionism are to develop a culture of appreciation, which I think will look different everywhere.
Yeah.
Where the organization takes time to make sure that people's work and efforts are appreciated. So I don't know about you. I've definitely been I've worked at places where you didn't really know when you were doing well, but you knew when you had done wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what would that look like to flip that around, right?
Yeah.
And offer more praise and...
Yeah. I really love the suggestion of when offering feedback, always speak to the things that went well before offering criticism. I think that's a great thing to just do all the time.
All the time.
Yeah. Even when you're talking to your friends.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I think here, too, an antidote that spoke to me was to develop a learning organization. So...
Yeah.
The problem with perfectionism is that there's also no room to mess up. And sometimes you need to be safe to fail.
Social work is messy, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think here, too, realizing that being your own worst critic does not actually improve the work.
Mm-hmm.
It actually contributes to low morale among the group and does not help you or your colleagues to realize the benefit of learning from mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
That really
hits
home for me.
Yeah. Catherine Schulz is an author who wrote this book all about accepting being wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I read a few years ago, and it was really transformative because it did kind of talk about like our petrified fear of ever being wrong.
Yeah.
And so we focus so hard on getting things right, and this affects how we respond when we're called out, when we do make mistakes, and we're not really learning how to learn from those mistakes.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, perfectionism.
And there's more that we could say about this. I might also mention that we won't probably pick apart every aspect of this article because we don't have time.
Sure.
But I would love to move on and talk a little bit about the characteristic of I'm the only one.
Yeah. What does Tema Okun say about this? Like, what are characteristics of someone who thinks that they're the only one?
Let me get to that part of the document here. Okay. So, that's only one right way. Sorry, I'm not where I need to be.
Which is similar.
It is similar. That's correct. Okay. So it's connected to individualism,
mm-hmm.
but it's the belief that if something is going to get done right, then I have to do it.
Mm.
I feel like that is something that we have all experienced.
Yeah.
So there's little or no ability to delegate work to others. So why is that connected to white supremacy culture?
Well, I think the first thing you said, which is it's connected to individualism, this idea of individualism, this ability to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, this all kind of comes, a lot of people believe, comes from the Protestant work ethic mm-hmm. that white colonizers, white settlers brought to this country.
Yes.
Whereas basically you and you alone are the one who is going to be able to do things to help yourself out.
And if it doesn't work out, that's on
you. It's your fault. Yeah. And so sometimes that manifests in ways we see in social work, which is like, well, I'm the only one that can actually do this the right way, so I'm going to do it. And there's almost like this martyr complex.
Oh my gosh. Too. Haven't we all worked with these people?
Yes, we have.
And I'm just like, ask for help.
I know.
It's so frustrating.
It is so frustrating. And it's hard to watch people struggle with that and kind of continue to over and over just die on that hill. And it's just like, gosh, it can be so much easier.
It could be so much easier. And you know, what I really appreciate about this conversation is that I have seen these people do that over and over again. And I've wondered, like, why can't they ask for help? I've never stepped back to consider that what's happening in that dynamic is connected to white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. I know.
This internalization of, if it doesn't work out and there was somehow, I was somehow connected to it, it'll be reflective of my character.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's another characteristic as well that's mentioned in this article, that part of it is also this desire for individual recognition or individual credit. I want to be the one recognized for saving this organization. I want to be recognized to keeping these people in their home. And I think, one, that's a lot to put on yourself. But also, what does that say about your trust in your colleagues, the people who were supposedly supposed to be collaborating with? Social work is an interpersonal relationship, right? Or a profession. So to have somebody, and this happens everywhere, but we're talking about social work, to have people who are social workers so driven on being the only individual who can do that really kind of belies the common, I guess, basis of what social work is, which is social.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want to set myself up like I'm the only one who has all the expertise, right, to get this done. And you mentioned people almost want to be recognized for being the person who saved the thing, right? That makes me think of the problem of power hoarding, which is another one of the characteristics that Tema Okun lifts up as part of white supremacy culture. And the way I think about that playing out in an actual workplace, as an example, is cross-training, right? If I'm the only one who knows how to do XYZ thing at this agency, then they can't let me go.
I'm indispensable.
I am indispensable. Yeah. And I'm not going to share my knowledge. I don't see the value in doing that whatsoever. And how awful that is.
All of us are always scared of talking ourselves out of a job.
But yeah. I mean, that... We'll just take a moment here, but some of you guys may or may not have heard the term the nonprofit industrial complex.
Yeah.
Right? Our goal is not to keep ourselves in a job.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal is to work ourselves out of jobs. When we are in a mission-driven organization, we want to see that through.
If you achieve that mission, it is scary to think that you wouldn't have a job, but okay, are you here for the paycheck or are you here for the mission?
That's right. You know, I think this is a moment that I just want to plug somebody that I really respect a lot, someone that I know here in Kentucky. And she took a job as an executive director for a nonprofit agency. And what she decided to do shortly after she started was to sit down and write her 5-year, I guess, resignation letter.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that she could hold herself accountable to, this is what I'm doing to, you know, bring good work to this agency, to take it to where it needs to go, to like really serve clients. And I'm not going to get so comfortable that my interest then becomes in just doing what I got to do to keep this job.
I love that idea too, of writing your resignation letter that early, almost like the anti-individualism, right? They're here for just a moment and I don't know. That note is falling away from me.
Oh,
that's okay. I was going to say something really profound, and then I'm just sitting here talking with my hands, and you can't see
and
that.
They can't see it. Know. Well, I will jump in, though, to say that another thing that shows up for me when we're talking about this concept of I'm the only one and how that fits with white supremacy culture, a way that I see show up in social services is this idea that agencies, social service agencies here in the United States, they beef with each other.
Oh,
they
gosh.
Have these turf wars around...
Yeah.
Who's serving what clients? Who's getting what funding? Well, you guys can't start, you know, coming into that part of the city and offering these services because that's our area.
That's our beat.
And it's, if we really care about the work the way we say we do, then we wouldn't be operating from this position of scarcity.
Yeah. And I think that's so unfortunate because, well, on the one hand, if somebody thinks that they have a better approach to doing this, you shouldn't just dismiss them from trying to do the same work that you're doing if they are going to approach it differently. Or...
it's an opportunity for collaboration.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
again,
community.
And community.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to act like these terrible dynamics don't exist where people who don't know what they're doing will sweep in and step all over the toes of people who've been doing good work for a long time. That's also problematic. So I'm not advocating for that. But I think that we need to take a long look at ourselves, a long, hard look at ourselves, especially those of us who work in nonprofit organizations and social service agencies, about whether we get real fussy when somebody else starts doing the work that we do and where that's coming from.
You know, this actually is a good segue, because I think a lot of times those of us who are at these organizations that get kind of turf protective, the other thing it kind of brings up for us is like, well, this is our beat. We got comfortable in this, and now mm-hmm. there's someone else coming here, and you're pulling me out of my place of comfort.
And suddenly none of this is about people in the mm-hmm. communities that yeah. we're supposed to be in service to.
So that's my segue into the next concept, which is right to comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that those of us who think that comfort should be prioritized over tackling some of these problems is a problem. So, and for me, I think that comfort specifically is related to privilege. And in this context, and for me, it's white privilege, but I also have like male privilege and straight privilege and all this stuff. And I think that sometimes we don't want to go out of our comfort zones because of what it might reveal about us. And when we deny that we have this privilege or that we have this comfort, usually it is to the service of perpetuating systems that deny other people this comfort.
Yeah, yeah. So in the article here, Tema Okun talks about that the right to comfort is the belief that those with power have a right to emotional and psychological comfort, and that they scapegoat those who cause discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
And this also is equating individual acts of unfairness against white people with systemic racism, which daily targets people of color.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this actually show up practically where social workers work?
Well, I think one big example for me is pay discrepancy.
Mm,
when we
let's talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk about it, because I love money. but at the same time...
Well, anti-capitalist who loves money.
Yeah, I know. Well, if I didn't have to live in capitalism, then I could reconsider it. But at the same time, we do have this culture of not talking about how much we make and asking people how much they make. That's really taboo to ask people how much they make. But it also does provide this level of comfort to those of us who maybe think that I'm making more than, say, Lisa over here.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I know historically that I'm a white man, and white people typically get paid and compensated and rewarded more than, say, Lisa, who is a black woman or a Latina. And so that comfort of me not having to address that is quite a privilege.
Yes.
But at the and I think that I shouldn't be uncomfortable because I also didn't make the decision to pay myself
this
much,
right? Rules.
I didn't make the rules.
This isn't my fault.
Right. And I think that's a problem that those of us with privilege have got to be a little better about sliding in there and disrupting that comfort. Not just our own comfort, but those people who are like us and share that same comfort.
Yeah, and you mentioned like so-and-so Lisa down the hall or whatever, who may or may not make more money than you. Another part of this right to comfort then, as it mentions in the article, is that then people who push back against that are deemed as complainers.
Uncivil.
Right? Uncivil. They're mm-hmm. seen as grumpy. They're sort of marginalized instead of being taken seriously because they're pointing out inequity.
Mm-hmm.
I had read something somewhere where this person was pointing out that if you get angry at folks who are pointing out these inequities, your privilege is showing,
mm-hmm.
essentially.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah.
And that, you know, if you think that when folks are criticizing these dynamics at work, you see that as uncivil and not supporting of like a collegial environment, your privilege is showing.
Mm-hmm. And again, it is a privilege to be comfortable
mm-hmm.
and not have to deal with those things when mm-hmm. that is the lived experience for so many people every single day.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I also wanted to add too that in terms of like right to comfort, actually, this is an example. Follow me down this rabbit hole for a moment.
All right.
You know, here where I work, where you work, if an agency that provides social services receives money from the federal government, they are legally obligated to provide language interpretation mm-hmm. services for clients who do not speak English.
Mm-hmm.
I see that all the time make people uncomfortable when clients or folks or consumers or however you say it show up needing services, and they don't speak English. And I have encountered some nonprofit agencies who just don't manage that well or pretend like they're not supposed to offer these services. Or what they'll do is that they will offer services like one night a week.
Right, because those are the only nights you're allowed to have a problem.
Right, yeah. Right. So where we live, Spanish is one of the bigger languages that people speak outside of English. And so you might find an agency then where Thursday nights is our Spanish language clinic. So if you speak Spanish only, that's when you need to come. And when clients show up outside of those hours, people are like, well, you need to come back on Thursday rather than me helping you now. It makes me uncomfortable if you point this out, that this is not equitable.
Well, there's also this thing happening in that, right? Like, okay, at this point, who's to blame for this inability to provide service? Mm-hmm. And in a lot of those cases, I think, oh, well, you didn't follow the rules of coming on the right night for you people. Mm-hmm. This is your fault.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, we don't want to be discomforted with the idea that, like, we're providing inadequate services or insufficient services because we're only allowing this for a small window of a week.
Yeah, but by providing interpretation at all, we think that we are doing a good job.
Mm-hmm. Instead of maybe reconsidering that we could do better,
yeah,
or we should do better. But again, putting that onus on a client to rearrange their life to come meet us when we are comfortable and able to provide the service to you.
And again, I've just seen this play out where what that has been critiqued as not equitable, as not right.
Yeah.
And then folks get in their feelings about it because they're like, it's expensive to offer interpreters and we're doing a great job by having an entire day devoted to, and it's like, no. Your privilege is showing,
mm-hmm,
again.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to back up if it's okay,
yeah,
in terms of just like, we talked about I'm the only one, but we didn't really offer any
you're
antidotes,
right,
to,
yeah,
that.
We didn't.
So
yeah.
I just want to lift up what is lifted up here in the article.
I actually really like this antidote too. I'm glad you re-steered.
Yeah,
back,
yeah,
to
no problem.
Yeah.
So again, remembering that I'm the only one connected to sort of individualism. One of the antidotes that's offered is that we need to evaluate people based on their ability to delegate to others. Evaluate people based on their ability to work as part of a team to accomplish shared goals.
God, I love the idea of getting evaluated based on how well you lifted up other people and not just how well you did something on your own.
Yeah. I know. That's like unheard. Like, oh my gosh.
That's a very different work structure. It's a really different culture that you're talking about there.
And I mean, we really value narratives where people have like scraped by and suffered.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that people can show us their pain and show us that they still made it, the more we love that.
Mm-hmm. And it's also used as an excuse for why don't other people do it then?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that to, mm-hmm, scapegoat other people, mm-hmm, for not doing better because you can find one outlier that proved the narrative wrong.
Exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, I think also just going back to reevaluating social work, it does really emphasize community and collectivization when your success is measured on how well you enable other people to do well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
I love that.
I like it too. And since we're on the subject of antidotes, let me offer some to this right to comfort that we've been talking about. So understand that discomfort is at the root of all growth and learning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's okay to be uncomfortable. And if you're not uncomfortable, you're probably not, you're not growing.
I think sometimes people confuse being uncomfortable with being unsafe.
Oh my God.
And I think that gets, I think people really feel that when they're uncomfortable, they're being unsafe. And there's a big difference between that. Like, I don't think you should be ever in an unsafe environment, but you should be in an uncomfortable environment.
Yeah,
to learn stuff.
I know.
And I think a lot of people treat those as synonyms or feel those as synonyms,
mm-hmm,
when they are very, very different.
Now, you need to welcome that discomfort actually as much as you can.
Yeah.
It's also critical, an antidote, to deepen your political analysis of racism and oppression so that you have a strong understanding of how your personal experience and feelings fit into this larger picture.
Yeah. And I think that goes back to also accepting your privilege and then trying to move beyond that privilege or even be disloyal to that privilege, because,
mm-hmm, that's,
you're
right,
not going to even begin to understand what it is like to be denied that comfort or to be targeted by oppression before, if you can't even acknowledge that you have the privilege to be immune to those things.
That's right. Yeah. So coming back again to like sort of the practical, tangible examples, you,
mm-hmm,
know, if you have coworkers, especially coworkers who have been systemically oppressed and marginalized, who are saying, this is not
mm-hmm,
right, and it's making you uncomfortable, instead of getting in your feelings about it, it's really important to sit down and be like, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what privileges do I hold? How do I show up in the world? I need to trust these folks.
Yeah. ask people what they make.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm really all about that.
Right. Especially if you're at a big organization. Like, I know a lot of healthcare organizations have, you know, a lot of employees. You know, if you're somebody that you know carry privilege in this world, and there is somebody who does not have that same privilege as you, look out for each other and make sure that, okay, I started at whatever, $55,000 a year, but they started at 50 and we have similar credentials. Yep. Why is that?
Right.
And challenge these things. Because again, this is how you become disloyal to privilege. This is how you subvert this comfort that you get to have.
Yeah.
And that is denied to other people.
Yeah. Well, let's slide into the next
yeah.
characteristic of white supremacy culture, which is worship of the written word.
Mm-hmm. So this is kind of a funny one, right? I think a lot of people are probably going to struggle with this because we are in an information-rich culture. Everything has to be written down. Policies have to be in writing. You got to sign these things. So, like, why is this so bad? Why is this a part of white supremacy culture?
Well, here in the article, the examples are, if it's not in a memo, it doesn't exist. The organization does not take into account or value the other ways in which information gets shared. And those with strong documentation and writing skills are more highly valued, even in organizations where ability to relate to others is the key to the mission. Hello, social work.
Right. And it does kind of put the carriage before the horse, right? Like, I would much rather have somebody who does have that emotional intelligence and that capacity for empathy well before I want somebody to use the right prepositions or to be able to explain themselves thoroughly in writing. Because we also have multiple ways to record information that isn't just writing.
That's right.
Just printed word.
That's right. And I mean, just to connect it back to what you had said earlier in our conversation around capitalism, because mm-hmm. this really, I think in a lot of ways speaks to this obsession with efficiency
yeah.
and time is money.
Mm-hmm.
So if things are streamlined, and I'm making air quotes that nobody can see,
I can vouch for them.
You know, then we can make more money, we can get more clients, we can be bigger, we can be more, which is actually another one of the characteristics.
Right, more is, quantity over quality.
But some practical examples then of how this shows up in places where social workers work, you know, hiring committees, for instance, choosing people or candidates who write stronger cover letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what hiring practices look like in other parts of the world, but it's pretty standard that here you apply for a job, you have to write a cover letter, which states your intent, and then you submit a resume or a CV along with that.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes you even have to have a written letter of recommendation.
That's right. Well. And sometimes you even submit writing samples
right.
depending on the position. Right. So what does it mean if somebody's a gifted writer and then a terrible interpersonal communicator?
Right. And we are prioritizing one form of communication here, which is really at odds with our social work, again, the social part of, mm-hmm. of this profession.
I think also avoiding academic language is really important. We see a lot of that in paperwork, in the agencies where we work.
Mm-hmm. Legalese.
Legalese too. Is what we call it here. Yeah, you know, you have a client who comes in and you need them to sign a form, and by signing this form you say that they've received informed consent for services, except nobody understands the fucking form, right? I don't understand the form.
Yeah, I could have just signed away, like, okay, I'm gonna actually pay a copay of one fingernail extraction
yeah.
every time you come in here.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you don't sign this, then we don't move forward with mm-hmm. care.
And it's also weird because it's almost like the Apple terms of agreements, terms of
oh
service,
God.
Right?
I never read that.
I don't either. But the thing is, I always think is weird is like, that's not a negotiable contract either. I've written it and you just have to agree to it.
That's a really good point.
Or you just don't get these services.
That's
so
right.
like this informed consent stuff, it's not also collaborative. It's like, I've written this up and this is the way I'm going to do it. You can sign it and I will help you. Or, good luck out there.
Yeah. You know, and then policies and procedures and protocols and things that sort of dictate how we do our work in these
yeah.
in these environments are also written in ways that aren't easy to interpret or really written to the benefit of the people in power. I mean, how does that serve us?
I can't tell you how many times I've been given a policy to read, and I can understand the words that are in it, but the concepts, I almost always still have to go and talk to somebody about it to get clarification.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, obviously, this is not the most efficient way to communicate.
I'm like,
so why
does this
are we
mean
prioritizing
that I get to
it?
Take 2 days off of work when this happens?
Yeah.
Or is it 7 days off? I don't really understand this. Does this mean I'll get fired if I ask to get off work?
Right. Yeah. And I think the other thing about the written word that really stands out to me, the worship of the written word, is how ableist this is.
Yeah, I'm glad you're bringing that up.
Not only to, for people of all kinds of different abilities, but I think prioritizing the advancement or the benefits of somebody because they have the ability to even write. Mm-hmm. Not even talking about the quality of the writing, but it is really ableist.
Yeah, right. The ability to read. Mm-hmm. When we had been preparing for this, we also talked a little bit, if you remember, about what this does is it devalues other ways of communicating. And another tangible example I can think of is preferring, for instance, to alert people to a new policy by sending it out via email to everybody at work, rather than having a meeting, coming together and talking to people about what's going on, maybe even before crafting a policy and getting people's input on it, but at the very least, creating a space for folks to really wrap their minds around something new, something that's shifting or changing.
I love that example you used too, because I think it is guilty of a lot of the other characteristics we've talked about, like, oh, well, I don't want to have to get into a discussion with people, so it's just easier for me to write this policy and email it out.
That's my
right to comfort. I'm also going to just set this right, and we're not going to have any team collaboration on it. So it's really individual driven. I'm the only one who can write this policy and you'll just have to follow it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these concepts, I think, do overlap with a lot of things. They are kind of all almost like a web of characteristics that if one's happening, other things are happening too.
I'm really glad that you brought that up because that's a beautiful example of how this is all really interconnected, because it might sound like we're just moving from characteristic to characteristic, but really all of this relies on each other.
Yeah.
Something else that came up for me in talking about worship of the written word too is that when everything has to be in writing, and then that means the folks who are the great writers, mm-hmm. right, get to control the narrative. And how what that means is that oftentimes like communities that are involved in the work, their voices are left out. Mm-hmm. And I think about that specifically too, in our country, this like really rich history of gay and lesbian and queer and trans folks fighting so that we could have the incredible HIV related care that we have today, mm-hmm. And how there's just such a history there, but if it's not written down, people don't know about it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I know that probably is the same in other communities and in other areas, but
That's a great example of that. So what are some antidotes to this?
That's right. Yeah. I was going to move on.
Oh, no, we got to tell people how to fix this stuff.
I know, right? So some of the antidotes that Tema Okun lifts up in her article here to combat worship of the written word is to take the time to analyze how people inside and outside the organization get and share information. So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Figure out which things need to be written down and come up with alternative ways to document what is happening. Work to recognize the contributions and skills that every person brings to the organization. So, for example, the ability to build relationships with those who are important to the organization's mission is a skill that we should be lifting up and appreciating.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure anything written can be clearly understood. So avoid academic language, buzzwords, legalese, as we say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's an example that came up for you recently that was kind of weird and timely that we were talking about this episode, and it was specific to social work, and it did encapsulate so many things that we were talking about, and it was weird. It almost was like a practical example of
and
all
it was
this,
like basically
right?
The universe was like, hey, you were going to do that podcast episode, and I know it's been some time, so here's a reminder.
Go. Yeah. Wink, wink.
Wink, wink. So I follow a Facebook group on Facebook. Yeah, I know, right? And it's called the QTPOC, so Queer Trans People of Color Mental Health.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that particular Facebook group, someone shared an article that was written on the website Medium. And the article is titled, Captain Save-A-Ho.
Mm-hmm.
Social work is no ally to marginalized people.
Mm.
I was like, oh shit, I gotta read this.
Some people are about to get in their feelings.
Some people are gonna get red.
Too.
Yeah. So it's written by Laura Lamoon, and we'll also share this on our social media.
It's a good read.
It's a good read, and it's an important read.
Yeah.
So it's not very long, but she talks about her experiences with sort of the toxicity of the social work environment, social work culture. And specifically, she talks about getting terminated from social work jobs from one in particular, because someone that she trusted shared, I guess at work, that she was in recovery for addiction, and so they let her go. And then she talked about how she was also fired from another social work job because she's a sex worker, and had a lot of really strong things to say about the profession, specifically that the client will never be able to exert agency in an inherently exploitative savior slash victim dichotomy. Which I was like, let's say that
is a cut.
And that, you know, social work as a like a system, as an institution, can't tolerate social workers who mirror client struggles. You know, and then, she advocates a bit for more peer-based models and just makes some really good points. And
she also talked about how, like, it doesn't tolerate difference really well either in the profession.
Yeah, and she she mentions also, I think, what we've talked about in this particular episode, how she's heard other social workers using racial epithets or laughing about clients. You know, again, what people code as venting, which is actually really toxic behavior. So it was really timely. I, of course, was monitoring the comments in
the Facebook group,
and it ranged from yes, thank you, like I'm trying to figure out a way how to, you know, to articulate this problem, to well, not all social workers.
It sounds like they didn't like being made uncomfortable.
No.
About the fact that maybe social work isn't perfect.
So you just summed that all up.
I know,
yeah,
right?
And that's, again, so like, you know, this is why her article, her experience, I'm really grateful that she is vocal about her experience, because I think social workers, we need to hear that people are getting fired from their jobs, right, because of their being sex workers or having, you know, drug addictions or...
Because there was an example in that Medium post, too, where I guess she went to HR and then they were like, well, you're not, it's not... talking about like the written word and the adherence to that, went to HR and like, well, I forget what it was. Like, you're not
sex workers aren't protected class
from employment discrimination.
Yeah.
And so again, because it wasn't in writing, this is like high level policy, because it's not a law, you don't have any protection. We're not actually going to do more than what is on the written word.
Yeah.
And we see that. I see that a lot. A lot of people want to do the bare minimum of like, well, I'm just going to do what this says and never actually go beyond. Maybe doing a little more proactive than what you're legally or mandated to follow.
Yeah.
But yeah. But yeah, we'll share this article because it is a good read. And
it's an important read, I think. Yeah. And I think she did, I mean, she just expertly shared a real life example of how perfectionism, you know, this worship of the written word, how, you know, you can't be made to be uncomfortable if you're a person of privilege, how that just shows up in social work and that we need to do something about that.
I thought it was really telling that so many people had a problem with her speaking her own experience and the struggles with social work, and people trying to criticize her for saying that social work has these problems.
Yeah.
And I just, it was... You know, it's
disappointing. Like, this actually happened to somebody. What's wrong with you, people?
Yeah, this is their personal firsthand experience.
Yeah.
That they published last year. This isn't even ancient. This isn't even out of the context. It's, you have to hear this.
So, you know, what is it in you if your first reaction is to be like, well, I don't do these things. So what?
I think, as we have said, that is really doing everything you can to hang on to that privilege so that you don't have to think about things that don't affect you.
Yeah. Well, we could go on and have this conversation for days and days. And there's a whole lot more to unpack from this article that I don't know that we have time to get into.
You know, the thing is about that, though, is kind of sensing some community coming around this podcast. And I think it'd be really cool to hear from some other people who listen to this episode about maybe ways that they have seen this come up in their organization and what they're doing differently.
I'm very interested in solutions, you know. So if you haven't read the article, we encourage you to do so. We'll post it on our social media.
Yeah.
And I would really implore you, if you haven't really given this stuff thought before, when you go to work, start to notice this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, notice how this is showing up where you're doing your practice.
Yeah. I think the real takeaway from all of this, too, is like to really question why the norms and policies your organization follows are the norms and policies your organization follows. Question that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, again, it's good to be back.
It's great to be back.
I am glad that we got to talk about this today.
Yep, me too.
It was hard, but this is good work. This is good work. And we look forward to hearing what you all have to say. And we'll see you next time, all right?
See you next time.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Decolonize Social Work, a podcast about social work, oppression, and liberation. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud at Decolonize SW, and on Instagram at Decolonize Social Work.